It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. An investigation conducted by the Pittsburgh Tribune Review reports Western Pennsylvania has been following a national trend regarding civil rights. Nationwide, over the last 20 years, the U.S. Department of Justice has declined to bring charges in 96% of civil rights complaints. Joining us in studio to address this issue are Tribune Review reporters Andrew Conti. Andrew Conti, welcome. How are you?
Good.
And Brian Bowling. Good day, Brian.
Good.
Also with us by phone from Washington is David Hickton, who is the U.S. Attorney for Western Pennsylvania. David Hickton, good to have you back with us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Sure. Thank you, Paul. Good afternoon.
And you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at ESSPGH. I'll start with the two enterprising reporters, Andrew Conti, Brian Bowling. I'm curious how you initially got onto this story. Andrew, you look like you're ready to start.
Sure. Yeah, thanks for having me back on. We got interested in the topic of federal prosecutions in general and how federal prosecutors decide the kinds of cases they're going to take. And Brian is the federal courts reporter for the Trib, and I've spent a lot of time covering cybersecurity issues with the U.S. Attorney Hickton, who's on the phone. When we started running the numbers, though, Brian built a database of 3 million records, every prosecutor's decision back to 1995. When we ran the numbers, the thing that jumped out was that far and away the number one thing that prosecutors declined to take were law enforcement civil rights cases. So this was, you know, some sort of a complaint against a law enforcement officer.
Like a Rodney King type case.
Yep.
For example.
Right. For example, right.
Where he is severely beaten by several officers that happen to be captured on videotape. And we'll get into that element of it. But these are the kind of cases we're talking about.
Right. And that case actually was prosecuted.
Right.
And the two officers were found guilty. So, but yeah, those were the kinds of cases we were looking at, incidents like that. And when we saw the numbers, it jumped out at us. We realized this was an important thing that needed to be out there. The public needed to know what was going on. And so that's where we put the data together. We traveled to Milwaukee, did some reporting there, and we also sat down with U.S. Attorney Hickton and his staff and had a great interview with them to get their perspective on how these cases come together.
And Brian Bowling, what were some of the things that you were looking into? Andy just outlined a number of them, but obviously there was some deep background that you went into, deep research in order to come up with 20 years worth of statistics.
Okay, I'm not really sure what you're asking, but the Justice Department, every month they release their national caseload data, and that's the basis for the investigation we're doing here. And like Andy said, we're looking at all sorts of crimes, but when we did the first run of statistics, just sort of comparing different types of crimes and the decisions made in them, the one thing that jumped out was the declination rate on the civil rights cases involving police officers. I'm not sure what else you want to know.
Well,
about
were
it.
You expecting to find
no.
a figure like 96% of civil rights cases involving a law enforcement officer were declined by U.S. attorneys?
No. That was, like I said, that's one of the things that really just jumped out at us. I mean, most other categories, it's much lower than that.
What were you expecting to find? What did you think? Where did you think the numbers would come in?
Well, what we are looking for and what we're still pursuing is, in different districts, they have different priorities on the kind of cases they pursue. And so we were looking to see, well, what kind of cases, for example, do you find in the Western District of Pennsylvania that you don't find in the Western District of Texas and vice versa? So that's where, and we were expecting, like I said, we were expecting to see some variation in, you know, drug cases or child pornography cases, district from district. For example, along the border, obviously, you see a lot more immigration cases, and that's what we were expecting to find. But what we saw was across the board this high declination rate on police civil rights cases.
Well, and when we got into it, too, we started to realize that there are reasons behind it. The federal law is very specific for police officers. There's a higher standard for law enforcement officers to charge them with a civil rights crime. It's not enough.
A higher
just,
standard than for
an average regular
person,
right. So it's not enough to just say, well, the officer has used an excessive amount of force. The prosecutors also have to prove that the law enforcement officer intended to to use that amount of force and intended to deprive someone of their civil rights. And on top of that, as U.S. Attorney Hickton pointed out to us, in the U.S. Attorney's manual, prosecutors are only supposed to bring cases that they believe they can win. So it's not like you just go out and pursue a case. There's a very high standard for these cases. And the other thing they explained was that anytime they get a complaint about a police officer, they open a file on it. So they've got lots of files. The standard's very high. And so that's why you end up with so many cases.
David Hickton, let's bring you into the conversation. I mentioned earlier the Rodney King case, which, if it hadn't been caught on video, probably, I think it's safe to say, would not have been prosecuted in all likelihood. Or even if it was, it probably wouldn't have turned out in or resulted in a conviction of two officers. How large of a factor, Mr. Hickton, has video become in the public demanding accountability from police-involved incidents across the country?
It's become a huge factor, and I think there are many people in the community who feel that it is a strong positive factor because disparate treatment was occurring, and it's now being captured on cell phones or other video. But as we have pointed out, video is not the beginning and end of a case because you often may get a piece of a video, not the complete video, and there are reasons why a video may not be disclosed because the investigation is pending, and a video can be a place of departure where people will start with the video and then they can actually make their story up around it if it's disclosed. So sometimes people are shocked to see that the video was held back, and often that's a necessary part of the process of building a case. So it's a piece, it's an important piece, but it's had a huge effect.
If police incidents often present conflicting testimony from officers and defendants, can technology help prosecutors resolve those differences?
Yeah, I personally am a strong advocate of body cameras, and I think they will protect police officers as much as they will protect the public from these incidents. This technology has been used elsewhere, and the same concerns that are expressed now about body cameras has been expressed before. I personally had an experience when I was in private practice with the location of cameras on railroad locomotives. You know, contrary to most of the rest of the world, we have intersections between trains and cars. Most elsewhere, they don't do that. And we have a lot of incidents where there are accidents, and they're horrific accidents when they happen. And there was a lot of reluctance to putting cameras on the front of locomotives because people were afraid what they would see. Hmm. And yet often they prove that people go around the crossbox to their own demise. And often they have led to greater opportunities for safety. And I think on balance, the use of that technology has reduced train and car accidents in a very dramatic way. And that's what I think will happen. But I think we have to get through a lot of culture change with regard to the feeling that this is intrusive upon the police process. It might misrepresent what happens. I think the important thing about the work that Andy and Brian are doing, which I applaud, but I think it's very important that we be careful because I've told them about the old saw about using statistics to our detriment.
Go ahead and say it, David.
There are lies, damn lies, and statistics. You have to make sure that you're comparing apples to apples. And they did a good report in the paper the other day, but there was at least one omission of a case, so it wasn't completely full. We did the Donis case as well, and the chart that they put there did not include that. I was heartened that they represented that before I came in 2010, there hadn't been any cases in this area at all in western Pennsylvania. But when you're comparing my district to other districts around the country, there's a classification difference about the way people classify their cases often. And as Andy pointed out, if you do a lot of civil rights outreach with a dedicated civil rights unit like I have, you're going to increase the number of cases, and therefore that'll artificially inflate your percentage of declinations over time. So, again, I think this is a very, very important discussion, and it's very good that they're doing this work, but I think we all want to be very careful about drawing final conclusions from statistical analysis.
And Brian Bowling wanted to respond to that comment.
Well, I just on the Donis case, I mean, as we had discussed with your staff yesterday, the issue there is that the way you guys coded it, it's not coded as a civil rights law enforcement case. We're not disputing that it did involve the law enforcement officer, but when we're comparing district to district, all we can do is go by the way you guys code the cases.
Right, but it's exactly identical in content to some of the other cases, and that just sort of proves the point. If you classify it one way or the other, you can get a disparate result. And I think the most important thing for me is that when we have this discussion, I think we need to put context into the discussion that the civil rights effort that I've embarked upon with a dedicated unit goes far beyond police misconduct cases or excessive force cases if they involve law enforcement or generally. It's a criminal effort as well as a civil effort. We're doing a lot of civil rights work. There's tremendous outreach work in there. You know, we have had, this will shock your listeners, Paul. I mean, we've had two cross-burning cases, and we're investigating a third in Western Pennsylvania in the last 5.5 years with 7 defendants. And I personally, through our Community Relations Service, have worked hard to stop 3 Ku Klux Klan rallies, including one as close as Export, Pennsylvania. And so civil rights as an endeavor is not just about excessive force. And I think in fairness, you know, we are experiencing, while at the same time we're very, very concerned about this work, we're experiencing a huge epidemic in violence against police officers. We just had another shooting in Prince George County down here where I am today, just yesterday. And Pittsburgh and Western Pennsylvania have been particularly hard hit by this. Any intersection that a person has with the police, we hope can be positive, but when it involves the criminal justice system, it's going to be negative, and it can lead to complaints. And then, on the other hand, you know, my hope would be that the police, and particularly the Fraternal Order of Police, would not try to defend every incident. Then one of the best things that the police could do would be, when they know that there is a problem, acknowledge it, admit it, and not fight it.
Well, there's a case that occurred in Millvale, which we can talk about, which is cited in the article. And again, we're talking with David Hickton, who is the U.S. Attorney for Western Pennsylvania, and also two reporters from the Tribune Review who've been investigating the decline among the U.S. Department of Justice in bringing charges of civil rights complaints against law enforcement officers. Brian Bowling and Andrew Conti are with us in studio. We'll continue this discussion. We have to work in one more break, and then we'll resume. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're talking about an investigation conducted by the Pittsburgh Tribune Review reporting that Western Pennsylvania has been following a national trend regarding civil rights nationwide. Over the last 20 years, the U.S. Department of Justice has declined to bring charges in 96% of civil rights complaints. We're talking with reporters behind the story, Andrew Conti and Brian Bowling of the Tribune Review. And also joining us is the U.S. Attorney for Western Pennsylvania, David Hickton, by phone from the Washington, D.C. area. You can join the conversation with a comment or a question at 412-246-2002. Brian or Andy, I'd like to have you explain the underlying law behind this whole story. And it addresses the requirement that officers must willfully intend to violate someone's civil rights. That's what you have to prove. And there's a story behind this, and it goes way, way back to the 19th century.
Well, it's the Civil Rights Act was born out of the Civil War and the Ku Klux Klan down in the South. And Congress passed the law to give federal authorities an ability to go after the Klan in the South. But when they wrote the law, they were specifically looking for people who were obviously going out to violate people's civil rights. And so it was written into the law that way. And there's a 1945 Supreme Court decision when the federal government got active in civil rights again in the 1940s. it was one of their first cases where they tried to hold three, a sheriff and two deputies responsible for beating a man to death. And they seized on the willful intent statute as a way to say that that's what gave the federal authorities the reason to step in. And of course, Dave would know this a lot better than I am since he's a lawyer. But, I mean, that's my understanding is that that's where this high standard comes from.
David Hickton, in your opinion, does this law need to be changed?
Well, not in the business of making laws. I have to always say that. But I have said that I thought it needed to be updated and that the people wanted to understand why sometimes we can't bring a case when it seems that we should. This is the reason why. And Brian has given an excellent explanation of the history of it. Now, it's been supplemented by the hate crime statute, the Shepard Byrd statute. But there are three reasons which create institutional barriers to us bringing the cases. One is we might have to have a high standard of intent, which under the principles of federal prosecution we can't meet. The second is that we might have to, as we do under Shepard Byrd, get agreement with the Department of Justice, which creates another level of approval. And the third is something called the Pettit policy, which, you know, many crimes, including these types of crimes, could be prosecuted state or federal. And a state assault charge is an easier burden to meet than a federal criminal civil rights charge. And under a Department of Justice policy, if the state district attorney goes forward first, then by policy of our department, we cannot bring our case until that case is disposed of. And generally, we can only bring our case if there are interests that were not covered in the state case. And that's just principle of jurisprudence which exists and we deal with. So sometimes you'll see us go forward first. Sometimes you'll see one of the 25 state district attorneys who are in my district go forward on a case, and that complicates it. So there are these other three components that go into this whole analysis.
And despite the factors that we've discussed here, I still would have to think that it is surprising, at least to our would be to our listeners and perhaps to your readers, gentlemen, who covered this story for the Tribune Review, that we're seeing so few cases, so few charges being brought when you have, for example, an array of video recording capabilities that didn't exist years ago. So wouldn't you think that more of these cases would be being taken on instead of the opposite?
Right. The experts we talked to, even when you take in all these factors into account, when you bring all this and put it on the table, it's still only 4% of the cases that are being prosecuted. And that was what stood out to them when they came back to us. When we shared our numbers with people who study this issue, said, you know, how could it be that there are only 4% that are prosecuted?
And David Hickton, there is certainly a case that you mentioned in the piece that would indicate that there are times where it, especially when you have video evidence, that it's obvious when officers have willfully intended to violate someone's civil rights, as was the case last April, where there was video of a white police officer in South Carolina shooting an unarmed, fleeing black man in the back.
Yeah, I mean, the case in North Charleston was particularly distressing. I mean, they're all distressing, and I can talk about that because it's not in front of me, but I just thought that was a murder. And there was an effort to put a taser on him, none of which would have been captured if there wasn't someone who, hiding in the shadows, actually used their cell phone to do it. And, you know, that's the one where I'm looking for law enforcement to say, absolutely outrageous, unacceptable. And most of the people I talk to, when you talk about that, accept that. But, you know, the proof that goes into a case is different than the conversation. I know this is very frustrating, but when you're trying to prove a case, I cannot manufacture the facts or contort the law if I'm going to do justice. And so we go through a very, very deliberative process in my office. Now, that said, I'm proud of the fact that we have a forward-leaning effort to do this because I believe the civil rights violation against anyone is a loss to all of us. I see civil rights as fundamental to everything we're about in this country, and that if someone is hurt by excessive use of force, it's a civil rights insult to law enforcement as well. And so we have this forward-leaning approach to it, and we're trying to get more cases, and we're trying to do more, better training with the police officer to reduce these incidents. And we're doing everything we can do to try and eliminate the problem of which, you know, bringing criminal cases is one tool. But there are a lot of tools in the toolbox, I like to say here. And, you know, there are many times when a civil case is the right outcome, not a criminal case. And that does not mean the justice system has failed. And there are many times when a private action, not government action, is the better way to go. And it's actually more in the interest of the victim. But what Andy and Brian have pointed out is that this does jump out as stark. And I do think that 96% is a large percentage of declinations, and I concede that if it's accurate in the particular analysis you're using, not overly dependent upon statistics and classification. So I think we're in the middle of a conversation. I don't think this is a static report, and I applaud these two reporters for their excellent work. They do generally good work, and I was happy to work with them, and I think there's going to be more stories that they're going to talk about. It's a continuing conversation of great interest.
One of the things that came up in the piece, there is a recent Western Pennsylvania case you are aware of involving a Millvale police officer who violated the civil rights of a young man who was being held. It was captured on video by another officer. What can you tell us about this case? Because this seems to be, we've only got a couple of minutes left here, but this seems to be kind of the poster child perhaps for how a case like this should be handled.
Well, we brought it and it led to a sentence. Some were unhappy with the sentence. And, you know, that happens often in cases. The sentencing is in the sound province of the judge. But I'm proud we brought that case. I think it was the right case to bring. And I think it demonstrates that law enforcement cannot use force when it is not necessary, and certainly excessive force when it's not necessary. And that said, these are challenging encounters for the police. And so they are all evaluated on their specific facts.
And gentlemen, referring to our two reporters, Brian and Andy, you had a case where an individual was handcuffed, he was being restrained, and he was being tased. Fortunately, another officer was there to videotape this.
Yeah, you're right. Fortunately, it was videotaped. I don't think it was being videotaped with a sense of justice in mind. You hear the officers are all laughing in the background, but the perhaps it was.
Why, if it wasn't being videotaped?
Well, I don't know. It didn't come immediately out. It was the public only found out about it because it was sent to the newspaper. It came to the Tribune Review, and it came to the defense attorney for the young man. And so that's how the video came out. But yeah, in this case, the man sitting on the floor was handcuffed, and the U.S. Attorney's Office brought charges. The sentencing he's referring to is that the officer was sentenced to 3 years probation, including 1 year of house arrest.
And people were unhappy with that. So we have just about 30 seconds left. Will we, as a result of this discussion, and it's a very fluid discussion, and as David Hickton mentioned, it's not a static situation, but will we see perhaps some of the requirements be eased a little bit in cases like this in terms of the burden of proof?
So Attorney General Eric Holder last year, before he stepped down, talked about perhaps proposing some legislation to change the law, you know, to give the federal government broader authority. He left office without making any formal recommendations. Members of Congress are talking about it. We'll see what happens.
Unfortunately, we've come to time, but I want to thank both Brian Bowling and Andrew Conti for joining us from the Tribune Review to talk about their investigation. Gentlemen, appreciate your being with us. And also David Hickton, the U.S. Attorney for Western Pennsylvania, joining us by phone from the Washington, D.C. area. Mr. Hickton, thank you for taking time out of your schedule to join us.
Thank you for this important discussion.
And we are out of time for today. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.